This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome to the Marvel Age podcast featuring the Sarcastic Four, episode 14, 1970, part one.
Stan was not hiding what he was doing. He was giving his characters psychological dimension. He was making them rounder and rounder people. These were people with problems, with misgivings. Like, I can run through a brick wall, but do I want to? And so what? You know? So my friend can't run through a brick wall, but he's got a happy marriage. That kind of stuff.
I tried to do a team of heroes that would be a little different than we expected. First of all, I made them more like a family.
I'm trying to make them sound like a guy's sitting around the kitchen table having breakfast instead of having a meeting, a formal meeting at in a huge hall of the Justice League. He'd have the guys putting their feet up and, maybe somebody soaking his feet in a tub of hot water.
There had been a comic book a million years ago called Plastic Man, and the character could stretch. But it was a humorous type of thing, but I always felt that would be great for a serious hero. So I thought I'll give our hero the ability to stretch, but not wanting him just to be a copy of something. I felt he'll also be the greatest, smartest scientist on the face of the earth. And to make him, again, not a cliche, not a typical guy, I figured he'll be the most boring human being in the world, a little bit like me. He talks too much, he uses big words, and the others, especially the Thing, will always be saying, "Will you shut up?" You know? So I thought that would be fun.
Place to Be Nation! Pop! Hadn't done that in a while. Welcome back to the Marvel Age podcast, our year-by-year journey through the entire publication history of the Marvel Universe as we know it. Starting all the way back in 1961, we have worked our way up to this episode covering part one of 1970. I, of course, am one of your co-hosts, Nick Duke, alongside the rest of the Sarcastic Four, beginning with the other half of the Southern contingent, Mr. Russell Sellers. Russell, how are you tonight?
I'm doing really well, sir. I am ready to talk some 1970s Marvel. It was a pleasure to read some of this.
It is the turn of a new decade, so we are in a new era of the Marvel Age podcast, as we'll discuss here in just a few minutes. Also joining us, as always, Mr. Tim Capel. Tim, how are you tonight?
I'm doing pretty good. In spite of my obtuse, obese unawareness, I'm very pleased to be with you and excited to enter the decade of the 70s.
Well, I don't know anything about obtuse, but I can certainly relate to obesity. So there you are. Also joining us, as always, the fourth member of our Sarcastic Four, the manager, Todd Weber. Todd, how are you tonight?
Obtuse, obese, and I'm thinking of another adjective that starts with O, orgasmic. There we go.
Oh. The best of these things. It's always
involuntarily
great to be obese and orgasmic. Oh. What? Oh, involuntarily. Man, good for you. Good
your Grant Morrison you, character.
Oh, God.
Nick, off you just don't get me.
Off to a rip-roaring start already. Well,
won't say that.
As we do, each time we begin a new year here on the Marvel Age podcast, we're going to kind of start with some expectations coming in. But before we get to that, we kind of have something of a bit of a housekeeping item that we need to take care of. Some of you, probably none of you, have been looking at our reading list spreadsheet that we shared with you back when this entire endeavor first began. Some of you, again, probably none of you, have been trying to read along with us on this journey. Well, you have heard over our first decade of this show, not decade of real time, obviously, it only felt that long when you were listening to it, you have heard us express our frustrations at various times with the reading lists, reading lists that were put together by Dave Busing over at comicbookherald.com. Now, you may have noticed in recent months that when this show first started, we were often praising Dave, giving him all kinds of shout-outs, sending people over to his site, and generally trying to help him out a little bit. Not because we felt an obligation to, but because we just think his site is good, and still do, for the record. I think we all are big fans of what he has going on over there. Lots of content, lots of resources there for anyone seeking a place to get started for just about any particular character in either Marvel or DC. But Dave and Comic Book Herald recently launched, not too long ago, the My Marvelous Year podcast, which is essentially doing the same thing we've been doing on this show. So when you combine our frustrations with the lists with the fact that, you know, not to say we're competing, because Dave, I would, you know, wager probably already has more listeners and I know is already generating revenue from his podcast. It just kind of didn't make sense anymore to use his work as the basis for our lists. Now, are we going to ignore his list outright? No, we're not going to do that. We're still going to obviously take inspiration from that. We're still going to consult him as we would any other resource. But it kind of made sense to us to kind of start to branch out and seek to solve some of our frustrations with the reading list. So that is where, good listeners, we turned that effort over into the very capable hands of Tim. So, Tim, why don't you tell us a little bit about our reading list and kind of how you took on this task? Because when we first started talking about making the changes, I had to admit, when it comes to 1960s and 70s Marvel, I wouldn't know what to tell you to put on a reading list. This is mostly new stuff to me, with the exception of maybe some Daredevil and some Thor and a little bit of Spider-Man along the way.
Yeah, and to be honest with you, I'm somewhat in that same boat, in that the 60s and 70s are certainly not my bag baby when it comes to Marvel or, frankly, any comics publisher's history. I mean, I'd be much more confident just off the cuff based on my own knowledge and reading and the resources I have at hand coming up with like an 80s, 90s type of list. But mm-hmm. with the 70s, you know, I almost looked at it as, well, who am I to think I can even do a better job than the list we're already from? But, I mean, the reality of it, I guess, is just to build off of what you said before. There were enough what I felt like were omissions, things that maybe we didn't know we were seeing at the time, but going back on, it's like, hey, this already happened. How come we didn't read that issue mm-hmm. or this rather momentous storyline? That, again, to take nothing away from Dave Busing, and, you know, he's not here to defend himself and can't really give his rationale as to why something made his list and something didn't, so...
But by all means, if you want to hear that rationale, he does talk about it on mm-hmm. the My Marvelous Year podcast. I've listened. It's a good show. So I give it an endorsement for anyone who wants more of what we've been doing.
Right. So I guess I'm not saying that I feel like he got it wrong and we're going to get it totally right here. We're going to come up with a better list. I don't know. It was gnawing at me enough that I felt like maybe just in keeping with the premise of this project, if we feel like we could come up with a better list for what we're trying to accomplish here, then why don't we do that and not bitch about what someone else has essentially put together and laid the groundwork for? I mean, that works for them. Doesn't necessarily mean it has to work mm-hmm. for us. So, I mean, it has been kind of an entertaining running gag, though, bitching about what's on the list, what's not on the list. But I think it's maybe gotten a little old, and I will fully take the hit for anything that goes off the rails in this episode, because this is the first one we're working with a list that is not Dave Busing's of Comic Book Herald. I do want to say that this is still publicly available in a Google Doc. It is titled Marvel Age Remixed, and I've really just gotten started on, you know, putting together what a prospective potential revised reading list is going to look like, but we'll make sure this is out there for anyone who wants to follow along. And we'll see how this episode goes. Like, right. At the end of this episode, if we feel like it's really terrible, we all hate what we read, and you all want to kill me, entirely your prerogative, and, you know, we'll go back to square one or take a different approach. But I guess that's kind of where we're at now. And, you know, it's just funny how I'd kept this running tally of why didn't we read this? Why didn't we read that? And now I'm thinking, like, have I really stepped out of my lane here and potentially bit off more than I can chew? We'll see. And I want this to be a very democratic process as well. You know, this is not, you know, me saying this is what we're going to read and tough shit if you did.
And I feel like it probably will become more democratic as we get further into this. By the time we reach the 90s and the 2000s, where all of us kind of have at least some basis of knowledge, we can kind of come to a collective, you know, agreement on what should or shouldn't be on the list.
Mm-hmm.
In the 70s and 80s, I am...
The entire thing.
I mean, the thing is, though, like, you know, and this gets back to it. I hate to have this long, drawn-out philosophical discussion before we even get into 1970, but the Clone Saga, we say that as a joke, and yet, if the stated goal of this originally was to cover not necessarily the best Marvel stories, but the most important ones. And like it or fucking not, the Clone Saga and shit like that has to be on any list of that because it dominated the publishing schedule for so long. And there are numerous examples of bad comics that unfortunately are important for one reason or another. So we will, of course, address those as we go forward.
And I have no problem with that. It's not that we're reading bad comics and don't like, well, we are reading some bad comics and don't like some what we're reading. It's just when we have stuff on here that feels like it's at the exclusion of other stuff that should be, that's where it turned into like, maybe we ought to rethink some of this here.
Absolutely. And now we'll have you here to defend your rationale for putting some of the stuff on the list. So
yell at me, then shout into the wind now. So by all means, call me on my shit as we go through this. I'm going to be counting on you people to do that because I get kind of obsessive and can be a control freak about the things that I am passionate about, and I've been very passionate about this project. Let me have it.
Well, Tim, I actually really like the list that you put together this time.
Okay.
And reading through it, I was able to make sense, you know, why each of these issues was here. It all fit a narrative to me. But maybe it's just because I'm not that familiar with Avengers or with this particular group. But we wanted to start talking about Avengers number 72. Mm-hmm. So what's your rationale here? Is it, you know, you've included it because of the first appearance of the Zodiac, which is the a group of villains, Zodiac-themed villains. So I'm not that familiar with them, so can you give me a little background there, like why this issue was picked?
It really is just the first appearance of the Zodiac, and I wanted to have just a little bit of Avengers representation here. Honestly, it was between this and another, I believe it was a two-part story that introduced a character called Archon and the dimension that he's from, and it's sort of like not really room for both of them, and neither are all that momentous at the end of the day, but the Zodiac are, I mean, it's a large group of characters that, while they never leave a huge mark in the Marvel Universe, they're going to come up over and over and over, and it just seems like if we're going to read much of anything from them, it ought to be their introduction, just to get a sense of who these guys are, and especially the Scorpio Key as well, which is kind of one of those funny Marvel MacGuffins that's going to come up even outside the context of these guys, certainly through the 70s. So some of that mythology is there.
I kind of appreciated that Roy Thomas would call back to Scorpio because I believe the last time we saw him was in Nick Fury, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Right.
With
Jim Steranko's
time. Yeah, with Steranko, where he was introduced. Yeah. So I appreciated Roy Thomas pulling this number and saying, oh no, he's part of a larger collective who are all Zodiac themed. So in that, I thought, this is a really cool idea for a new villain group who really could be a great foil for the Avengers. And as a first introduction, it wasn't bad. It was not great by any stretch, but still, I like the basic idea. So I was happy to see its inclusion. I was just curious if they had any like future involvement that maybe we should be looking out for.
I mean, nothing that I would consider that important, but I know we're going to cross paths with these guys again, and it's just – rather come into something like that knowing, okay, they're established characters, here's where they came from.
Yeah.
Even if the story itself isn't anything great. But, I mean, I thought this was okay. Plus, it's one issue, right? It's one and done. So, it's pretty easy read. I do apologize for the Rick Jones involvement.
God damn it, Tim.
The Rick Jones Marvel of it all.
I know.
They keep trying to make him a thing, and it's just I don't see it ever taking. I know that everybody says wait till Peter David writes him, but I think that so much damage has been done to this character in my mind that I don't know if Peter David could turn this around for me. I don't see it.
Kind of poisoned the well in a way. Just we're predisposed to really just detest Rick Jones on that.
Even in this issue, when he's given a moment to, of explanation from Cap, like, oh, this is why things went the way they did before. And he's like, oh, well, I'm still going to go over here and be a annoying, broody teenager about the whole thing. And it's like, for fuck's sake.
Yeah. Yeah. There was a funny bit here where, so it's, spoiler alert, it's Scorpio is Nick Fury in disguise, right? So, infiltrating the Zodiac, and that works well enough. It's very much suggested that there is another actual Scorpio out there who was a proper member of this team.
Yeah.
But in the process of going along with their plans, they capture the Avengers. He I guess hands the key over to who is it? Ares, one of the Zodiac goons, and it's sort of like, what happened, Nick? It seems like an important thing to get lost in the shuffle that you just handed over this very powerful device, which we don't know totally what its capabilities are, but seems fairly important to them and to this story, and he just kind of lets it get away from him. So
it's almost like
a wonky bit of plotting.
It was almost like they plotted up to that point and then said, oh, wait, we need another big twist in the story. What do we do? Oh, Scorpio is revealed to be Nick Fury. Wait a minute. He kind of fucked them just a minute ago. Whoops. Forgot to go back and do a little editing.
Yeah, exactly.
Shit happens.
You do get a pretty good fight scene, I thought.
Yeah.
It's sub-cinema art.
My still favorite Spider-Man artist, despite what Todd and Ben argued on Masterclass.
You are perfectly entitled to your opinion, Russell. We weren't trying to hurt.
Oh, I know.
We just disagreed. That's all.
It's all good. Although now I worried that you've ruined his 90s faces for me.
His 90s faces.
They ruled. And by I mean they ruled, it's because Sal was using straight line rulers to draw the faces. Everything was almost could have been vector graphics, if you will.
Damn it, now I'm not going to be able to unsee that.
I do think he's always had a good eye for just, I don't know what to call it, a fight choreography. And you see that even as early as this point in 1970. There's also some pretty neat, like, almost psychedelic visuals when it's like the three faces melding into Scorpio on the view screen that the Avengers are looking at, kind of at the midpoint of the story. That I thought that worked to pretty good effect. And you don't think of that type of thing from a Sal Buscema. So he kind of impressed me here.
I kind of dug his Steranko impersonation on the first page with the did you hear the one about Scorpio lettering, kind of mirroring some things we had seen in the Nick Fury Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. pages. So that was interesting.
Yeah.
But altogether, I mean, it's an Avengers book that heavily features Rick Jones and has kind of a silly twist at the end. So fuck it, in my opinion.
Yeah.
I sort of fear for the Kree Skrull War, which we're going to be reading.
Oh, God. An ass load of Rick Jones, I'm sure.
Kind of is.
Yeah, wonderful. Todd, you haven't said much about Avengers 72. What are your thoughts over there?
Well, I thought this was perfectly acceptable comics. I really did. I thought, despite Rick Jones and his primary colors and him being the same Rick Jones we have grown know and hate, this was decent. They try to get Captain Marvel over, I think, to a wider audience, right?
Yeah.
Special guest star. Carrots. Yeah, crossover. And the Zodiac, though, is an interesting concept. And it would have been really interesting had they gone more places with it, because you don't think of them as the classic Avengers villain. You think of still Scorpio, Zodiac. You affiliate that with Nick Fury, S.H.I.E.L.D. stuff. But yeah. Still, it was good. It's kind of a comic that if it were at your grandma's when you were a little kid growing up, you would have read it over and over, and it would have been fine when you were a little kid. As it is, it's still better than some of the Avengers stuff we've read to this point, and the art is fine. The art is pretty good, actually. I did like the two-page spread that introduced the Zodiac. That was cool. And, nothing really changed at the end of this issue. You get back to your status quo. Wasp has a new costume. The Zodiac Key is taken and lives to tell other stories later, which is its concept to hear. But, we'll see what happens with the Avengers when we come back to them. But this was okay.
Yep. Interesting. I think we'll probably move on from the Avengers at this point and hop over to X-Men. Tim, knowing your sensibilities, how much temptation was there to build an all X-Men 1970s list?
Well, I pretty much did, because this is all you're going to see from them in 1970. This is it for the X-Men. We read the last three issues of the series, and after 66, the book is effectively canceled. It's gone for about 9-10 months, and when it resumes publication with issue 67, it's a reprint, and they're going to stay in reprints all the way up through issue 93, and that'll take us into 1975 before we see any more new X-Men, emphasis on the new, on our reading list. So, I mean, in a way, I kind of did, but hear me out. I will say that issue 64 is the first appearance of Sunfire. Mm-hmm. Sunfire, never a major character, I mean, even in like X-Men mythos, but somebody we are going to see again. So
yeah, I got no issue with that.
Yeah, I feel like any semi-notable first appearance is fair game, right?
Right.
So you got that. You've got 65, which is the last Neil Adams issue. I mean, why not? Not to mention some pretty big developments. And then 66 is the last issue of the series, so go ahead and toss it in there. Let's see how these guys went out. I mean, it is the X-Men. So for curiosity's sake, if nothing else, then 66 I felt like deserves to be on here. So, yeah, I mean, it's three issues of X-Men that did we have to read? No, not necessarily, but I don't think it's getting in the way of anything else.
I would mostly agree. And it's interesting because, like you said, the book is near the end of its run, and it seems like, from an editorial perspective, they're kind of not really a priority, because here we see three different artists in the span of three issues.
Yeah.
Whether it's Don Heck in 64 or Neil Adams in 65, and then who did 66? Buscema?
66 was Sal again, yeah.
Just kind of a rotating door of artists. As to the quality of these stories, and we can kind of take them one by one, the Sunfire thing was interesting. I never knew that Sunfire was initially introduced as a villain, which is what we see him as here. So that was new information to me. Not the most subtle or well-written Japanese villain, but we take what we can get here in 1970. Todd, what about you? How did this one strike you?
Yeah, this is what passes for diversity in 1970s Marvel.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was fine. Roy Thomas and Don Heck getting a little bit more photorealistic. Not bad art. Maybe it's because of Tom Palmer, who was the inker for this issue and was kind of the regular inker for Neil Adams stuff. So it thematically seems to fit okay. You get the new look of the Angel continuing, and hey, you know, it's a Sunfire story, and much like Banshee, who comes back along with Sunfire, you have a precedent. You have a character who was introduced in the X-Men and is going to show up and do, well, bigger things for a very short time in Sunfire's case. But it's nice to trace it back to here. Not that much happens other than Sunfire's introduction in 64, though.
Yeah, and I mean, you described, Todd, Avenger 72 as like a perfectly competent comic. I don't know if those were your exact words, but I kind of had that note for this issue of X-Men. It was better than a lot of Silver Age X-Men that we've read so far. Just no great shakes, but just a pretty pretty well done one and done issue. There's no like Silver Age cringe or stank that you get from a lot of these things. That, I mean, this is a book that, while it's in its twilight, has matured quite a bit. And I mean, the writing from Roy Thomas, we've been pretty complimentary of on this title, at least. And I mean, this art from Don Heck is really, it kind of knocked me on my ass. Not that it's the best overall art we've seen, but for Don Heck art is like pretty stunning. Maybe that's, as you said, Todd, Tom Palmer on inks helping him out a bit. Maybe he's trying to ape Neil Adams in his style. I don't know. The coloring seems like it's also improved, and I don't think there's a credited colorist at this point, but I think that does help quite a bit. I mean, the layouts alone are a lot more inventive than early Don Heck stuff, so it seems like maybe he's been given some more freedom, some more leeway that he didn't have working early Marvel House style, and he kind of shines here. So I'm quite impressed, and can't believe I'm saying it, but looking forward to more Don Heck work in the years ahead and the little bits that we will encounter it.
Yeah, he's definitely steadily improved from where we first found him, I believe, in the pages of Tales of Suspense or what else did he do? Daredevil, some Daredevil stuff as well.
Yeah, he did Avengers for a while, too.
Yeah, yeah. So definitely.
Well, I mean, his early X-Men was not like this at all.
Right, right. Russell, what were your thoughts here?
Of the X-Men issues we read, I think this Sunfire issue was probably the one I enjoyed the most. As much of a kind of caricature Japanese villain as Sunfire was, I still enjoyed the motivation of the character. Like you guys, I thought Don Heck was really showing out. And yeah, he was kind of doing a Neil Adams impression, but hard to fault him for that whenever he was actually kind of sort of pulling it off. Although when you frame it like that, it does kind of just make me wish that Neil Adams had just drawn all these issues and, you know, given us the genuine article. But as a story, it was not bad. It introduced a character that I was actually genuinely wanting to see more of at the end. And I found the issue to be kind of ballsy for the time because it ends on a bit of a downer note. Mm-hmm. And that's something that a lot of these books seem to try really hard not to do when telling superhero stories. So it was nice to see a book like this that would take that kind of chance and show, I guess, a multifaceted world, which is something that they haven't really done too much of to this point.
Nice, yeah. I would agree. I would agree. It was okay. Didn't exactly knock me on my ass the way it did some of you guys, but a decent issue nonetheless. Moving on.
Now I want to talk one little thing I forgot. So it's revealed that Shiro, Sunfire's mom, was in the Hiroshima nuclear blast, and that's why he's a mutant, yeah?
Yeah, that's the implication anyway.
Why are there so many American mutants here in the X-Men? White American mutants.
Isn't it
television?
Isn't it odd?
Yeah. Oh, I get you. Yeah, the TV.
Yeah.
Some kind of radiation was turning. I don't know. I just, when they try to explain one
yeah,
mutant.
I know what you mean.
It begs the question, well, why why are we mutants? Did we just
aren't there a whole lot? I mean, not to be morbid, but why aren't there a whole lot more?
His mutation wasn't even triggered until he touched the irradiated dirt from Hiroshima.
I think part of it, Todd, is that George Wallace actually stood in the schoolhouse door of Xavier School for gifted children.
Yeah. Oh,
and George Wallace?
No.
No.
Oh, in Birmingham where they love the governor. That guy.
Yes.
Boo.
I mean, this could be retconned into cell phone towers today. I mean, the X-Men are not, but what? The Marvel Universe is not, but 15 years old or so.
Fair point. Yeah, it's always that rotating timeline, right? 15 mm-hmm. years? Is that what's generally accepted?
Yep. Yeah.
Oh, man, that can get
so it's really Sunfire's great-grandmother, I guess, that died. And anyway.
And started the mutant family.
That means that the entire Marvel U is now post 9/11 in history.
Yeah. Time is a bitch. It's a right bastard. Sunfire, also a member of Clan Yoshida.
That's right.
Who we will see later in the X-Men comics. And one other note, I was introduced to Sunfire, not in X-Men, but on, excuse me, the Amazing Spider-Man. Actually, it was Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends cartoon show in the early 80s. And
yeah.
They had a
Sunfire-themed
episode where he hooked up with Firestar. Yeah, Angelica Jones, who was a character created for Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends. And later wedged into the Marvel.
And the Ultimate Universe, as I most well know her, where she was indeed an amazing friend of Spider-Man. So there you go. Moving on to 65. This, Tim, help me out with the pronunciation of this alien race. Do it for me.
Actually, Todd, you help us out. Don't you?
This is the Znox.
The Znox. All right.
Going out for Znox. I used to call it the X-Nox, but it's the Znox.
Yes. Why did you call them the X-Nox?
Because my memory, I didn't remember that it was Z.
Oh, okay.
Z apostrophe N-O-X. I always think it was X apostrophe N-O-X, and that's not true.
If you're British, I guess they're pronounced Z-Nox, right? Say Z? I don't know. Depends on if you actually pronounce the Z or try to...
Z-Nox.
As you did, Z-Nox. So, anyway, they are the... kind of nondescript alien race that I don't believe we ever see again. Which
I was wondering, it was laying the foundation for
something
that would be picked up later on.
It's merely here for the sake that it's Neil Adams' last issue, and it does bring back Professor X. Now you might be thinking, what do you mean bring back Professor X? Was he? Well, he was dead for the better part of 2 years.
No, not dead. He had faked his own death and had been hiding in the basement.
We all thought he was dead.
Yes. Thought he was dead. Pulled a fast one.
And Jean apparently knew the whole time.
Jean knew the whole time. Continued the rich tradition of Professor Xavier deceiving the shit out of his students.
I was about to say, how many times at this point in history has Professor X pretended to be dead to avoid the X-Men?
Pretended to be dead. Now, dead is a loaded word, of course, in all superhero comics, but in Professor X's case, I mean, he'd been comatose, fake comatose. he'd pulled a fast one a few times here. And the way that, I mean, we didn't read the issue where he quote-unquote died, but the person who died in his stead was the Changeling, who was a shapeshifter that he granted a portion of his telepathic powers to. So that is a thing he can do. Fair enough.
And I am to assume the Changeling was the inspiration for Morph on the animated series years later. Because he looks just like him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Just older and kind of creepier.
Yep,
that is exactly who it was. And weirdly enough, we'll see him again later too. So he also does this trick with Jean Grey as well, gives a portion of his telepathic powers to her, which actually turns into she had the power all along, and he was just sort of unlocking it. Anyway, it's a whole thing. And now he's basically combating this alien invasion that no one else seems to quite know about yet, although S.H.I.E.L.D. kind of gets the jump on it, and it's implied that they make things worse. So, the X-Men race to the rescue here, and it's one of those gloriously ridiculous scenes of the team combining their abilities and beating the Znox with the power of love, essentially. How do you top that?
How indeed? Doesn't Professor X have sort of worldwide mind meld? He does something? Mm. I didn't quite understand the purpose of that, but... admittedly, I was skimming at this point. The art was great, but I must admit I was not blown away by the Znox or as a villainous concept.
Yeah, he was just kind of mentally holding hands with all the world.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. And then shooting it in a beam of force to Jean, who shoots it in a beam of force into Cyclops, who turns it into an optic blast.
That just... Good God, that was real bad. I mean, really?
Yes.
It's.
Oh no! Wait, I'm sorry. I forgot Havoc's important role in this process. He's boosting the
yep,
the love beam with his cosmic powers.
And Neil Adams is apparently so proud of that panel, he does it four times in the issue. Slightly different each time, so it's not just a cut and copy paste. He actually draw that four different times, and
overwrought scripting as well from Mr. Thomas.
He is a little
actually written by Denny O'Neill. I'm going to jump in here and schmock you.
Was it?
Yeah, this
Denny
is
O'Neill.
This is Denny O'Neill.
Well, that can't be. Is that Denny O'Neill?
Yep.
Oh my goodness.
He's in the credits at the beginning. This is the
wow.
You know, first time that I'm aware of O'Neill and Adams working together, but of course they would go on to better things.
Yep, sure is. I never knew this. Amazing. Amazing Dennis O'Neill overwrought scripting then. I apologize to Roy Thomas.
can't blame him for this one.
No.
Like they put a year's worth of story compressed into one issue, and unfortunately they did it. Maybe they couldn't have told an interesting story in a year, but a lot of things happened in this book.
Well, and which was kind of crazy considering the first three pages they waste on about going in the fucking house. I mean, it's a weirdly paced issue for sure.
Maybe it started out as an annual and then they got the stance that we're gonna wrap up X-Men. So
right, and they got the word, yeah.
They bring back, because, I mean, a lot of big stuff. Return of Professor Xavier is a huge thing. The restoration of that status quo and seeing Havoc and Lorna. I don't know that she's Polaris at this point.
No, just Lorna.
You know, have your extended X-Men team, the team that shows up in Giant Size X-Men, number one, which happens years from now. Which this kind of issue felt a little bit like that to me. Just a lot of things happened, and you know, the Xenox, they deliberately exploded their vessel, and we must run away, never to return. It's a gift for later writers that no writer has chosen to open yet.
Yeah.
There you go.
I think that gift is...
It sits unclaimed after all these years. Moving on to 66, this one saw at the conclusion of 65, Professor X, stop me if you've heard this before, goes into a vegetative coma-like state, and the X-Men have to set off in an attempt to save him. The only mental clue they are able to get from his mind is that it has something to do with the Hulk, and so we set off for an X-Men versus the Hulk story. They have to find this, some sort of device that is going to probe the mind of Professor X to figure out how to draw his personality back out. I don't know. You know, this was okay again. Notable because, like you said, Tim, it's the last bit of X-Men we're going to get for a while.
Mm-hmm.
But again, none of this X-Men stuff was necessarily my cup of tea, I would say.
Yeah.
I kind of thought this was all right. I mean, it's not momentous to go out on by any means, but fun little fight with the Hulk. Okay, cool. I'll take it. Again, some good fight scenes from Sal Buscema. Mm-hmm. Roy Thomas is back. I'm totally second guessing myself now on these credits, but I do see his name. So, for whatever reason, he took 65 off, is back here. But you know, I thought this was kind of okay. The Hulk is being written in a way that is sort of more violent and brooding than we've sort of become accustomed to. Like, it's not full on dumb Hulk yet, but we seem to be getting there. And yeah, I mean, the ending is sort of like ambiguous in the way that, remember those early FF issues that we read where it's like every issue seemed like it could be the last one. Mm-hmm. And very well possibly could have been. And that's a bit what this is like. So, I don't know. I thought it was fine as an issue in a vacuum, but as the last issue of a series, it's sort of like, oh, really? That's it?
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't have the greatest ending in the world or anything, but, I mean, it does kind of give you that little hint there at the end where they say, and they fought happily ever after. that's the last thing you'll read on the page. So I guess they were kind of telegraphing, hey, kids, this is it. We're not going to really bother publishing any new stuff from this for a little while, if ever. But I actually didn't really hate how Hulk was written here. I thought it was one of the more interesting Hulk stories that we've read up to this point, and at least gave Bruce Banner something to do. It showed the other side of Hulk and gave his character some much needed depth, something that his solo book and I felt like most of his guest appearances in other places just have never even really bothered with. So for me, not a bad use of him, and certainly made the whole like MacGuffin bit a little more interesting, though still not a great issue overall, like you guys said, but certainly not, I don't think it's the worst issue of X-Men we've ever read, and certainly not the worst issue, I think, in this month's reading list.
No, certainly none of the X-Men stuff we read this time out was bad. It's just, a lot of this is kind of forgettable to me.
Anyway. Yeah, it is. I'll admit that most of this was forgettable, other than how laughably silly the plot of the previous issue to this one was. That's the only thing that kept it with me, and the Neil Adams art. And the Sunfire stuff stuck with me proper so than the Hulk stuff did. But thinking back about just the overall plot that's presented in this issue, not a bad setup, but I think like Todd was alluding to about so much story being crammed into so little space, there was to stretch this out to tell it in a more compelling way. But instead, it's definitely like the sales numbers must have just been terrible on this book. So they said, all right, let's just hurry up and wrap this up, and we won't really bother with anything new going forward.
You mentioned Todd. Todd, what were your thoughts on this one?
Yeah, probably my least favorite of the three X-Men issues, but still not terrible comics, just average comics. And we got Roy Thomas back. We had Sal on art and the Hulk. I did enjoy the Hulk's character fights and the Banner secret lab aspect. And hey, it's logical that Banner and Charles Xavier had collaborated or at least known of each other in a past life. So there it is. Not my favorite, but it was okay. Really weird how they just wrapped it up and said, and they fought happily ever after.
Yeah, like pretty much, says. Yeah.
It just, okay, we're done. I mean, we don't see a lot of canceled books at this point. So just to think that they pulled the plug on a book that was 60-something issues in is kind of interesting to me. But then they kept it in. You know, they took a couple years off, and then they put the reprints in, I believe. I think Ben was saying. They just didn't want to spend any more money, but they wanted to keep those characters in circulation and use them. The Beast certainly gets interesting stuff happening soon. Angel, maybe a little bit. And Iceman. Iceman starts turning up in other places. So we will see the X-Men other places in the Marvel Universe, but in their own book, it's done. We return to the status quo, Professor Xavier as well again. Hooray, hooray, it's 1970 and the X-Men are okay.
Yeah, and then when they come back, well, we know they come back in 75 and in number 94 when they start publishing new issues. But I was just looking on Marvel Unlimited and it skips from 66 to 94. So they didn't bother uploading that because they are, like you guys said, they're reprints, but I'm not sure where the reprint starts. Like, what did they start reprinting with?
I want to say it was kind of a random. They do go sequentially, but it doesn't necessarily start with the first issue. I think it's kind of a random, like maybe issue 5. I don't know. I don't know why that number is in my head, but
it could be. Anyway. I was just curious if you might have known, but yeah, when it skips to issue 94, it looks like where the Claremont era begins.
Yep, that is correct. You have to think, because there were no trade paperbacks, there were no back issue shops, reprint stories were important to Marvel. You had Marvel Tales reprint Spider-Man, you had Marvel Superheroes doing reprints, and I guess they're turning X-Men into that. So the only way to learn previous exploits of your characters, unless you were lucky enough to find somebody who had these issues somewhere, was to read these reprints. So they were an essential part of Marvel at this time. There's no reason for us to check them out, but just think reprints were still a blip on their radar sales-wise. They were still an important thing that the company dealt with, bringing revenue in and keeping these characters in circulation and educating readers as to, okay, oh, this is how Spider-Man got his powers. This way you don't have to do a recap in every single issue
right.
of what's gone before.
A good point. And, of course, we will check in on the X-Men later as we continue our race here on the Marvel Age podcast to catch up with the Conversation Comics podcast and see who gets through the Claremont era first. I'm starting to like our chances, although you guys are back on the board now, so you're trying to make it a little bit of a contest, I think.
Yeah, I wouldn't hold your breath. I mean, we'll see. But we're going to try and go monthly from here on out. And I said that for a few months, but... Yeah, I encourage, if you're listening to Marvel Age, go back and check out Conversation Comics. I put a link up on the Place to Be Nation page that had all the previous episodes of this run. So if you want to go back and just listen to them from the website, you can do that. Also, they're on iTunes if you want to check out where we are. And we did just cover the Dark Phoenix saga. At least we're smack dab in the middle of the Dark Phoenix saga. And she just made roasted broccoli.
Headcanon for the Dabari people was completely unacceptable, but that's just who we are. Yeah, check out that episode. It goes places.
All right.
Issue 67 reprinted the Juggernaut's first appearance, it looks like.
Gotcha.
It was a 52-page giant, it says. And I was looking at mycomicshop.com at the issue summaries. And then it just rolls through, like, the Sentinels. And a bunch of these were oversized issues that it was bi-monthly. So once it comes back in those reprints, it's bi-monthly, I think, for the duration until it, you know, goes up to 93, 94, get new stuff again.
Awesome. Well, moving on, let's check in on the Fantastic Four as we're going to look at Fantastic Four 99 through 101. This notably, I believe, is the first of the Marvel Universe titles to hit 100 issues. Yes, some of the other ones have big numbers or whatever, but Thor, for example, was originally Journey into Mystery, which was an anthology book. You have that instance in several other cases. Fantastic Four from the jump was just Fantastic Four, and here we hit this milestone. So let's look at these three issues as we're nearing the end of Jack Kirby and his time during this stint with Marvel. So, Tim, tell us a little bit about these three issues and why they landed on our reading list.
Well, I sort of feel like wherever possible, we ought to cover anniversary issues.
Mm-hmm.
Unless nothing's happening in them and there's other titles that have real important monumental things going on. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, it's sort of a big deal that a Marvel original in the Fantastic Four has hit 100 issues. And 100 issues, we should stress, under the single creative team of Stan Lee and Jack Kirby.
Yep.
And notably, interestingly enough, issue 100 of FF, not double-sized or anything, just a standard, 20 pages of story. They didn't do that for issues within the regular series itself too often, I noticed back then. I mean, certainly annuals are going to be double or triple size. We'll get into some king size and giant size specials as well, but within the series itself, doesn't matter if it's got two zeros at the end or is divisible by 25. It's just going to be a standard length comic. But what they do within these pages, I was pretty jazzed by. Admittedly, I don't know that 99 had to be here, but kind of
I was going to say, it didn't necessarily have to be there, but I liked it. Like, and I might be in the minority on that. I actually think it was probably my favorite issue of Fantastic Four we read for the simple reason of we have dealt with in both through this project and in the modern day continued attempts to make the Inhumans interesting and relevant and a thing. Mm-hmm. And to see Johnny Storm just tear through them like they are nothing is pretty fucking satisfying, I have to say. Like, every attempt they make to stop him from doing whatever the hell he wants, they're all pretty ineffective throughout this entire issue. So, yeah, it was an entertaining read for me, personally.
Excuse me, but it's pronounced Inhumans.
No.
Yes.
No.
Yes. Just like the Eternals and the it's called the Inhumans. My friend Tim told me this.
I don't know if I have detected a difference, to be honest with you. Inhumans versus what?
Inhumans.
Inhumans, we're arguing where you put the emphasis. In
other words. I just wondered that, just because Inhumans, every time Inhumans, there's a team like this, I think of the Eternals.
The Eternals. Yeah, well, stay tuned, I guess.
Yeah, the Fantastic.
Right. The Fantastic Four. Crystal here of the Inhumans, kind of a total fucking badass. Who knew?
Yeah.
I mean, this is the first time we've seen her use any real powers offensively. There we go again. And
character-wise, she's always, I mean, through this project anyway, she's been the least offensive in human. Like, you can deal with her
sucks the least
from time to time. You don't want her to just go away like you do the rest mm-hmm. of them.
But she holds her own and, I mean, really gets some pretty good licks in with, you know, I mean, she's almost a fifth member of the team in a way. She's wearing an FF uniform.
I was about to say, isn't she in the costume, at least by issue 100? I don't remember if she was in it in issue 99 or not.
Not so much in 99, but I think like going forward, the next two issues, she's basically she is the fifth member of the team.
Which makes sense because it's a family concept. And they've kind of, you know, Alicia has become an ongoing, you know, recurring character at this point. So yep. It makes sense to have her be there full time. So she's got power, throw her in her costume. What can it hurt?
And I like the bit at the beginning with Dancing Thing. I thought that was a nice bit of comedy. It made me laugh.
This is Skiing Thing on this one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right.
Yeah, skiing. The skiing That's comes right. first.
Dancing is later.
Dancing is 101, I think.
Oh, yeah. They get to that later. Sorry, but the whole pretty much all of things bits work for me throughout all three issues. The Inhuman stuff, I'm still pretty lukewarm on it. Even with, like, Johnny does walk through the vast majority of them until he gets to the royal family. Mm-hmm. And then they kind of really give him a run for his money. And then Crystal unleashes a bit of fury on Johnny as he's being, you know, pretty irrational and, like, getting up in her face. So don't really blame her for setting him on his ass, but at the same time, I'm like, boy, teenagers are hard to deal with. That's my takeaway from the issue.
And it's still a little bit unclear how old they're supposed to be. We know he's in college, or was in college. I don't know that age is the concept for the Inhumans, but in any case, yeah.
Somebody's fighting it. Somebody's trying not to say it. There it is.
No, I have recently just started saying it that way. I don't know why. That'll be my thing.
Yeah. The thing with all the villains coming back, and although they're not the genuine articles in any cases, but still works pretty good, especially for an anniversary.
It's kind of a nice gimmick to not have have like a storyline reason for all the actual versions of them to be in one place. It's kind of just a cool thing, you know.
Think you can get away with that once
anniversary gimmick. Yes.
Yeah. You can get away with having truly all of them, which we did in that annual where Reed and Sue got married, which was so good. But to go back to that well is going to feel pretty contrived. So yeah, just have them be robots basically. Robot Dr. Doom still thinks we really, really should care whether he and Kang are the same person.
Is anybody else laughing at that besides me? Because what a great joke. What a great moment.
And actually, right before that, when he tells Thing, I despise informality. My full title is Doctor.
Doctor.
After Thing, yes. First name is Doc Doom. That was a cool touch as well.
Doctor.
Oh, my God. Like, yeah, you have to. You really have to just take these books as being meant to be funny. So I suggest maybe read them first and take them as that. Because I was reading it after all these super serious X-Men issues. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, man, this like feels like complete change of gears, and I was unprepared. So now I have to like set my mind in a different zone altogether, because this is meant to be funny. And it really is.
So, yeah, that was 99 and 100. What'd you guys make of, okay, I need another pronunciation here. Todd, how do you say Magia?
Oh, yeah.
It's the Magia.
Magia?
Magia.
Magia.
Like the mafia, but with the double G.
Yeah.
Like John DiMaggio.
It's so hard to say. Yeah. Magia. I will never be able to say that. I've never even been able to, like, in my own head, I'd stumble over it when I read it, and I'm like, it's always been like that. I do not have a definitive reading of this term.
And it's weird. To me, it's like the first thing that doesn't work in this run is the mob getting involved with the Fantastic Four. It just feels very fish out of water. I am tickled by 100 just with the Puppet Masters. The only good Puppet Master story I may have ever read. But yeah, the Magia taking on the Fantastic Four just does not work for me. They've been using him in that particular group in Spider-Man for years and years, the mob stand-ins. And, you know, we're avoiding ethnic stereotypes of Italians, but that was a thing. People were enamored with the Godfather book at this point in time. Yeah. So that was a big cultural touchstone, and here it is in the comics, and, you know, you can have an endless supply of bad guys with mob, but we can't say mafia because you don't want
to get in trouble.
Yeah. I just have to wonder who is the bookie in the bullpen. I mean, you had the Buscema brothers, right?
Yeah.
And the Romita family. Mm-hmm. Hey, Stan, what are you doing over here?
Yeah.
What are you saying?
Yeah, I'm not going to indulge my impulses there, because I don't want to make the Magia mad either. But I don't think it's a terrible gimmick of them purchasing the Baxter Building. It's, I mean, kind of funny, and just saying they're going to evict the Fantastic Four. So even though they're out of their league power-wise, they can still, through quote-unquote legitimate means, be a force to be reckoned with. But we do get the very goofy at the end here, like Scooby-Doo villain reveal of the, who is it, their doorman, who takes off the plastic face mask, basically. And it's just like, well, not for you meddling kids. We would have gotten away with it.
He wanted to crush them all. Legal.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
His name is Gimlet.
Yes. Gimlet.
So, yeah, this was, I mean, I think kind of like Todd is saying, just a weird mash of concept. The Fantastic Four up against the Mafia, essentially. Not really a thing that works. It was okay at best, I think. I think the favorite, my favorite of these three was 99, even though 100 was fine as well. So anybody else got anything to add on 101 before we take a little break?
Just comfort food, you know? Lee and Kirby comfort food, especially 99 and 100. And boy, I do, Russell, I love that dancing panel too.
Yeah.
Whatever antidepressant thing is on has really worked, because he was such a jerk the early years of the book. And right. I enjoy reading the thing so much now, at least in these books, that it's like they tweaked him, they got him right, they found out what works for him, and how he feels like a family member. It's great. That thing has become somebody I love as a character now.
I think that the giving him the relationship with Alicia is really what like elevated that character to the next level and gave them new ideas of how to work with him. And making him more like an actual uncle character in the book has really worked. But as far as this issue, yeah, it's kind of like you were saying, Todd. It's comfort comics. It's easy to read. It's nice. It's uplifting. And yet, I actually found this to be the most directly engaging issue of the Fantastic Four stuff we read, mostly because I really just I dug a more grounded story for these characters, something that we don't often see, because most of the time they're fighting some like huge cosmic threat or something from another dimension or the Inhuman stuff. You know, it's really rare to see them do anything like this. And overall, I thought it worked as super silly a concept as it is. And I'm not really sure they understand how building ownership works. Because you get to the end here and they're like, well, he tried to kill us. Yeah, we caught him. Yeah, he still owns the building. You're technically still trespassing on his property. And that means that you will be under arrest pretty soon.
So yeah, they do kind of leave that hanging.
Yeah, they just leave that out in the air. It's like, but he still owns the building. He has a right to defend his property. You're the invader. Yeah, I think we're all just going to sweep this one under the rug, and it's going to be forgotten about by next issue.
There's a no prize involving Matt Murdock and yeah. An offstage court battle that is ready to be won. But yeah, I'm with you, Russell.
Yeah, it's like we left a very important thing just dangling here, but you know what? Screw it. They'll forget it next issue.
Awesome. Well, with all that being said, guys, I think we're going to go ahead and take a quick break to advertise the other shows here on Place to Be Nation and Place to Be Nation Pop. When we come back, we have saved the best for last in this issue as we move on from things that we kind of gave mixed reviews to things I think we were a little bit higher on. We're going to tackle The Amazing Spider-Man 83 through 87 and Thor 175-177. Stick with us. We will be right back.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have over 24 podcasts available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. We now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, we dive into topics running the gamut from today's WWE to the glory days of yesteryear and the ins and outs of the territory days. In addition to our full-length shows, we also deliver to you special pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation Pop feed is a veritable treasure trove of great content. Offer tremendous shows covering the land of movies, television, life, comics, and sports, brought to you by the most knowledgeable and insightful folks in the podcast world.
You can find all these great shows, plus archives of our past podcasts from over the past 8 years, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while you're there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth search projects, and much more. Be sure to support our site by using www.PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping. We want to thank our friends at Boneheads, Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com as well. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome back, Marvel Age listeners. We hope you enjoyed that quick commercial break.
About what we got going on at Place to Be Nation right now. We've got a variety
at this point. First of all, starting off on the pop feed, there's a little show. You know, you may have heard of it. A little show that happens to be the longest running weekly episodic comic book podcast in all Place to Be Nation, the Hard Traveling Fanboys. That's me and Greg. We went off the page to check out Marvel Rise of the Secret Warriors. Meanwhile, over on the NBA team, the boys gave a quick hit March Madness 2019 preview. You can listen to the preview as you prepare to watch the second weekend of the tournament. I think it'd be a good thing to do. Jason Sherman joined host David Sunday for the newest edition of Easy Like David Sunday for part two of a look that was released between 1998. What a time period. Meanwhile, speaking of time periods, Andy, Scott, D'Amato, and Dr. G continued their trek through time with a new year in pop, delving into all things 1974. Speaking of 1974, Todd Weber joined Ben Morse to finish up their look at 1969 in a new Marvel Age class. And finally, speaking of Todd Weber, he was joined by Tim Capel for a look at Uncanny X-Men 135 on the most recent edition of Conversation Comics. Look at all that tightly woven continuity. Wow. On the Place to Be. Just impressive. But that's not all we have to offer. Of course we have the wrestling feed.
Yeah, over at PTBN Wrestling, in the newest Place to Be podcast, JT, Scott, and Jennifer Smith, they take a look at the February 1989 Madison Square Garden house show. That sounds absolutely riveting. JT and Chad returned with a new Wrestling Warzone podcast, digging into the Christmas night, 1995 edition of Nitro, featuring a great Randy Savage versus Ric Flair world title match. And in episode 3 of Talking WCW, featuring our very own Tim Capel, Jennifer Smith, and Greg Phillips, they examined 3 matches from the catalog of the legendary Ric Flair. Which matches were those, Tim?
I guess I can go ahead and give you that scoop. The matches we looked at, chosen by Greg Phillips, was Ric Flair versus Bobby Eaton from Clash of the Champions number God only knows.
It was last from, not asked.
It was from July of 1991. I know that. I think it was 15. Anyway, Danny chose the legendary showdown between Nature Boy and Vader at Starrcade 1993. Somewhat of a divisive match for some people. Where do we stand on it? Listen to the episode. Find out. And I will say that for my part, I almost chose Ric Flair versus Randy Savage from the aforementioned Christmas Night Nitro. But I am familiar with the concept of synergy. Knew that would be coming up very soon on the Wrestling Warzone podcast. So instead, I went with a Ric Flair versus Sting match from November of 1995.
So a little stunned there are no Flair Steamboat matches on that list. That's
well,
interesting.
We might have other ideas for Flair's
Gotcha.
Steamboat.
Gotcha. You know, I gotcha.
We might have other ideas, but for now we're trying to answer the question, what's causing all of this? We'll see if
indeed we are.
So he says to Rick Steamboat, why don't we have a match? Why don't we do great? Greg Phillips. my imitation of Greg Phillips. Imitation of Ric Flair.
That just happened.
Into there. It did. It was a thing.
Ric Flair gift, though, is just...
Is this to Jim Bird?
That was a little Krusty the Clown-esque.
And be sure to check out placetobenation.com, the recently rebooted, reformatted, and restyled website. Things are getting back up and running there. March rolls in. Content is picking up, and check it out. Click every day. We need those hits. And shop at PlayStation/Amazon. I did that wrong. What is it? Amazon.com. What's the link? Does anybody know?
PlayStation.com/Amazon.
There it is. /Amazon. Buy your supplies. Buy your toiletries. Buy whatever you need. These shows don't pay for themselves, gosh darn it.
Buy your sex toys, because those are expensive, and there's a high margin on those, and they won't cost you any more, but we will get, you know, a kickback off of your purchase.
Buy your baby powder over there. That's what
Do some high margin items. Mm-hmm. Okay.
So anyway, that's a thing. And finally, who's going to talk about the other thing?
Last but not least, be sure to give a like to the PTBN Greatest Candy Tournament Facebook page. You can participate in daily polls as we determine which candy is indeed the greatest of all time. The polls also go out on Twitter. Things kicked off on March 10th, and the champion is going to be crowned on Easter Sunday. Do you guys have a favorite?
Well, what they don't tell you there, Tim, is it's actually Easter Sunday of 2020. I believe currently we're in the round of 1,024, trying to get it narrowed down eventually to a more manageable number.
Hey, man, a lot of candy. There's a lot of candy represented. All the candy, in fact.
My favorite candy is a big honk.
I don't know. I have strong feelings on candy dots. That's the one I have strong feelings on. Yep.
Well, candy cigarettes.
Blue chew a candy, Conrad.
The same fucking thing. Oh, God, what else? And what else, in this case, is the remainder of our reading list for part one of 1970? We told you before the break, when we came back, we would be picking up with some Amazing Spider-Man, so let's do just that. As we dive into Amazing Spider-Man 83 through 87, a story that, features... And this new underworld villain of the Schemer, I believe, is what I have. Is that right? The Schemer?
Yes.
And his showdown with the Kingpin for control of New York's underworld. Meanwhile, as there is always in the pages of Amazing Spider-Man, there's some drama in Peter's personal life as he is, you know, feeling the financial woes. He is increasingly under suspicion of his girlfriend, Gwen Stacy, and he has come to the decision he's just going to tell Gwen. He's going to tell Gwen his great secret about being Spider-Man. He's going to just come clean to her, and that kind of sets the stage for everything that will happen over these next five issues. They all kind of tie together with that one central theme of how to best resolve this Gwen-Peter conflict. I loved these, all of them, and I'll tell you why. I love Spider-Man when it is not really about Spider-Man. It is something that was ingrained in me from my earliest entry into comics, monthly comics with the Ultimate Universe. It is always something I've enjoyed. And so seeing a heaping helping of Peter trying to solve his relationship problems here in these five issues to where it feels like that's almost the dominant storyline over whatever's going on, it was right up my alley. It was a big plate of red meat for me. So I fucking love these. And I understand I will probably, you know, be higher on them than most everybody else. Tim, what were your thoughts on these Spider-Man issues we tackled here?
I'd set pretty high on them too. And I'd been a little bit disappointed by our Spider-Man. Not that what we've read has been bad by any means. Just I don't think there's been enough Spider-Man that we've read so far. And while the Schemer doesn't exactly take the world by storm here as the great villain find of 1970, I do sort of enjoy that fake out, and it builds into the kind of the Fisk family dynamics that we're going to see a lot more of and get quite a lot of mileage out of.
That's a good point, Tim. Can you, for our listeners, tell us who else is featured in these first three issues here?
Right.
Besides Spider-Man and the Kingpin?
Yes. So you have Spider-Man, his villain, the Kingpin, Wilson Fisk, and you have their wayward son, Richard Fisk, and you get as well.
Oh, Richard Fisk is dead. He died in Europe, didn't he?
Is he?
He's dead.
Well, we also have the debut of Wilson Fisk's wife, Vanessa.
Yeah, there it is.
And yeah, so I gather she has been mentioned before. We've seen that. I don't know that we've even seen her name brought up, but
yeah, I wasn't sure either. I thought this was the debut appearance of her, but I wasn't positive, so I didn't want to.
On panel. Right. On panel, I believe it is the first time we have seen her. And she's a somewhat interesting visual. she also excels at passive aggression, as I noticed. Kind of
throwing kind of girl. Shade.
Yeah, wow. Now, less said on that, perhaps the better, but
she does have Gerard Jones, Hal Jordan temples as well.
That's right. Yeah. A little bit of grain going on there. But I mean the whole thing with the Schemer, I mean you can see the swerve coming from a mile away. But I kind of like that better than the alternative of the Schemer as like just at face value, that's what he is. Because Spidey sure has a lot of villains with a name like the does a thing. Like you have the Schemer here, you've got the Smuggler, the Looter, the Answer, the Burglar, who isn't really called the Burglar, but he is. And it's just like just such a generic kind of concept. And what's going on with that costume course? He's got a weaponized desk and souped up car. It just feels like a character that is in the comics to shill for an action figure playset. You know, it's just not all there. But kind of like the reveal, as obvious as it was later on. And boy, we're going to see a lot more of that particular character and his relationship with the Fisk family. So laying some of that groundwork here. And yeah, I like the interpersonal dynamics as well. Oh, something else I noted. It was in issue 83.
Mm-hmm.
Get a scene where it's just Peter and Gwen, you know, out on a date, and they almost get run over by a car, right? Mm-hmm. It's part of this whole, the Schemer's trying to consolidate power and take over the Kingpin's empire. They're just kind of incidental bystanders to this. and they almost get crushed under this under the weight of this this truck that's been knocked off the road. And Gwen is knocked out, Pete holding it up, and it's like this. It's kind of an inversion of the whole Spider-Man lifts a heavy object thing, because here he's not really struggling to lift it. It's more, if I do this, I'm going to expose my secret identity. So it's like, it's really, I don't know, you know, as much as we've seen that trope exploited, it's really kind of cool here, because it's not that he's screwed if he doesn't lift it. He's screwed if he does lift it. And no. There's something to that, I guess.
What's convenient parking meter.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. What's more remarkable to me about that particular scene, Tim, is that he resists the urge to just let the truck fucking hit her after he had to watch her full-on French Flash Thompson a page earlier. Like, you know, there had to have been at least a part of it that was like, you trifling bitch, you know? Like,
It's the
70s. Yeah, that was the 70s. He probably liked it. Anyway.
You got Flash Thompson, jerk of all jerks, gets to kiss Mary Jane and Gwen Stacy both within three panels.
My, how far we've come.
Man, it pays to be a dick.
I guess so. Well, and this also speaks to the fact that this is a Gwen Stacy who has a personality.
Right.
And I think that's something that gets lost, you know, in later, in modern readings of her, when people who didn't actually, weren't actually exposed to the character as she was at the time, and it's all through flashbacks or, you know, characters reminiscing and the way they talk about her, she's this kind of pristine, perfect, saintly Silver Age girlfriend. And, I mean, she wasn't really. She was very much a character in her own right. That may change, but here she's a fully formed character.
Yeah, we're kind of getting, you know, it is on the horizon, like kind of the landmark event. Like, arguably, like the biggest thing to happen in the Marvel universe from a narrative standpoint is coming in the next few years. So I'm going to be really interested.
Not on the list.
Of course not.
Well played.
To track her character in particular as we build to that. Because like you said, it's something that a lot of people aren't familiar with. Or if they are familiar with it, it's either through the kind of the whitewashing of the character, you know, for taking away all of her flaws, or if she has flaws, they're having Norman Osborn's secret love children. Or they know her as kind of the more like Emma Stone version of the character from the Amazing film. So it's just, you know, I will be interested to see how she evolves over the next few years.
Or the alternate universe version of Spider-Woman, who, you know, I'm not a huge fan of the concept. It seems derivative to me, and yet it's commercially very successful. So, people do know her.
Yeah. They do. Russell, what were your thoughts here on these issues?
For the most part, I enjoyed this. There are two things that just kind of sticking out to me, and maybe there are little things that don't bug anybody else, but the schemer, ain't nobody busting any brain cells coming up with that one. And but when the reveal about him is brought to light, it started. I gave it a little bit more of a pass. I'm like, okay, I kind of get why he would have gone with that name. Now it's something that a kid would have come up with. And if anyone were to actually play the schemer, say a film, there is clearly only one choice to do it, and that would be a star of large and small screen, Ray Wise. Otherwise known as Leland Palmer from Twin Peaks, because my God, the schemer looks like a dead ringer for him.
He does now that you mention that. I hadn't been mentally casting him in my head, but now that you say it, I'm like, oh yeah.
See, now I'm an old school Sopranos guy, and I saw Polly Walnuts as the schemer, but not everybody has that reference. And so I read him as Polly Walnuts, which is pretty bad. I was just trying to take care of things, don't.
I love that by the end of I think it's 85, we have the Kingpin in a Linda McMahon like vegetative state.
Thank you.
Yes.
If you hadn't said it, I would have.
Like, I mean, doing the full Linda, sitting in a chair, staring straight forward.
Yeah.
Next, I want Vanessa to go out and find the hottest dude in the Marvel universe and like make out with him in front of vegetative kingpin.
These issues also kind of serve to set up, or at least in my mind as I was reading them, I was like, oh, so this kind of brings the idea of where Sam Raimi might have been getting his Spider-Man Loses His Powers deal in Spider-Man 2.
I'm glad you said that, because did we not read another story that had him being sick and losing his powers like very early on in the in this project? Or yes. Am I making that up?
No, we
did. I don't think he was sick, but he
was not sick. It was like a almost like a mental block, but it seems to be a recurring thing within the pages of Amazing Spider-Man. Is every so often they go back to that he's got to lose power as well, and it's they've already done the mental block thing that you mentioned earlier. Yeah, so now it's a severe case of the flu.
So it's that be careful what you wish for. Kind of got to show him. Go ahead, Tim. I'm sorry.
Well, I was just going to say it still suggests that there's a psychological element to this, where as soon as he realizes it's just the flu, he's like, oh look, my powers are back.
Yeah, and he recovers immediately. It's like as soon as he identifies that it's the flu, he's all better. Right? Mm-hmm. Sniffles, the aches and pains and everything, gone. He's fine. And, yeah, it's kind of ridiculous. But I wanted to ask, what did you guys make of the Black Widow introduction, that reintroduction of Black Widow that we get in 86?
Didn't bother me, and I'll tell you, I think it was just because they had decided they wanted to revamp the character, and before they just plopped her into what is it, Amazing Adventures, I think that she winds up there with somebody
Seriously,
else.
Seriously, not on the list.
Yeah, not on the list. They kind of wanted to use a big-selling book to kind of say, hey, this is our new version of the Black Widow, and that's all that it kind of was to me.
I was going to say, I appreciate, Tim, you putting this on the list because this introduction of her more modern costume. The look that we all know Black Widow as having, it first appears here.
And it's funny, like I had never thought about how 70s jumpsuit this look is, and it's going to remain her default costume for such a long time. I mean, they kind of keep going back to it, in fact.
Yeah.
It looks really good, though. It works so well for her.
I like she well. You guys, you know, we mentioned the sickness thing. We should state that the Kingpin schemer stuff takes place in 83 through 85, then 86 and 87 kind of sees Black Widow and predominantly deals with Peter being sick or whatever.
Yep.
87 in particular, I wanted to kind of get into a little bit more because, one, it has an outstanding cover as far as I'm concerned. I'm not as well versed in the ways of art as Todd is, but I know in terms of what I look for in 70s Marvel covers, I love this cover. And also, just the content of the issue is just, it's so quintessential Peter Parker to me because it gets back to that idea of he's one bad decision away from being a villain. You see him mentally, physically, and emotionally exhausted. Like, he's sick, he's afraid he's losing his powers, he thinks he's failing in every relationship he has, whether it be with Aunt May, who he's never at the bedside of because she's constantly at the edge of death, I've learned, for her entire publishing history. He's failing in terms of not being there for Gwen, who was recently injured. He's failing in terms of not being able to financially even buy Gwen a gift. You get that great scene of him actually breaking into a jewelry store and coming this close to stealing a gift for her. Just all kinds of great stuff. You get him like delirious with exhaustion, stumbling into the party and confessing to everyone that he's Spider-Man, and then he has to go figure out how to cover up his own fuck up. It's 87 in particular. Loved all of these, but this was easily my favorite of the bunch.
Yeah, it's a real shit show of Peter Parker-isms throughout that entire issue, and I mean that in the best possible way. We always hear about that bad part, that just rotten Parker luck throughout Spider-Man's history. But an issue like this actually serves to show that, no, buddy, you kind of do this to yourself sometimes. And, like, I was struck by that scene, too, in the jewelry store whenever he just tears the door off of a vault to steal a pearl necklace because that's subconsciously, I guess, what he wanted to give Gwen. But, then he stops himself and puts it back. But I kind of waited for a minute thinking, Okay, is he going to take this and like leave some money on the counter or something because he's just like this desperate to get her a gift? But no, you're right. He just starts to walk out and then stops and says, wait, I'm about to straight up steal this. So interesting impulse that they wrote for him in this issue.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that takes
and yet he
a minute.
Overcomes it, which is, I mean, just a great hero moment, showing the temptation and then overcoming it.
Right, and it takes a minute for the scene to actually register with you as a reader. You're going, mm-hmm. wait, what's going on here? What's he doing? And it's a good way, it's a really effective way of putting you in the headspace of the character, who's also sort of like, wait, what am I doing? And it was the way it was kind of sudden worked so well. I mean, this is a Peter Parker who is way more neurotic than I think we've seen him written before, and it almost threatens to cross the line to just plain unlikability, and that's mm-hmm. a ballsy thing to do with your protagonist, leading man, superhero. So yeah, I mean, I definitely got a lot out of, especially issue 87 as well, where we get the happening.
Absolutely,
I do still
Todd,
like.
Todd, I feel like we haven't. Oh, go ahead, Russell.
I was just going to say that I still really like that, even after they seem to resolve everything. At the end of 87, Peter can see that Captain Stacy is still pretty suspicious of this whole thing. Like, he's not really fully letting it go. Like, he's starting to see through this this facade that Peter Parker's got going on, but he doesn't want to give too much away yet. So I think that we're starting to see the cracks forming in the illusion that Peter Parker is putting up, at least as far as Captain Stacy is concerned.
Yeah. Todd, I feel like we haven't heard from you too much on these Spider-Man issues. Go ahead and weigh in for us and tell us if you were as high on them as it sounds like the rest of us were.
Spider-Man 83 through 87 is Silver Age gold. Just wonderful retellings of this Spider-Man versus Wilson Fisk. We've got a lot more dimension to the Kingpin, but 87 especially is probably the standout issue, like we've been saying, where Spider-Man has to deal with this morality tale of him being sick and his defenses being lowered. You've got all the interesting stuff, he and Gwen. Gwen's suspicious of everything, and he exposes himself as Spider-Man in a classic page, full page, one page thing that could be a poster, right? Could be just like a snapshot of that, and then Harry calls it that this has happened before, where Spider-Man's got this, or Peter has this connection to Spider-Man. I think we need to talk about our friend Hobie. Nobody's talked about Hobie
right.
yet.
Right, yeah.
Well, we didn't have the first appearance of Hobie on the list, I don't believe, so I was kind of nice job, thrown Tim. Off by this, but I eventually put it together.
Not my fault. Wasn't in the 70s.
That's right.
79.
I cannot take responsibility for 1960s reading
this. I cannot. I can't do it. Yeah, it said this guy, he's the Prowler, who we are told has appeared before, is another costume vigilante who Spidey is kind of pals with now in the city, and approaches this guy and says, hey, can you do me a solid? So, what's his name? Hobie Brown, is that right? Mm-hmm. Poses as Spider-Man in costume while Peter Parker appears as Peter Parker to throw people off the scent, which is kind of the second time just in this run of issues that he's sort of pulled that trick of just trying to create separation between himself and Spider-Man. And it's just, my God, Peter's propensity for fleeing these uncomfortable situations, trying to find any loophole, any workaround is just breathtaking here. I kind of love it in a way. Gave me a sort of vicarious feeling of anxiety, too.
Yeah.
I love how easy, quote-unquote, easy it is for him to get again, uh-huh. you know. Yeah. It just seems that, oh, you know, if you had invested, this is what you would do. But it always works. It's worked a couple times now. All you have to do is be seen where you're not the character. I mean, we've done this with Superman. We've done this with every alter.
Notably in the Marvel Universe, I'm thinking of, like, how many times have they gone back and forth on that identity as known or unknown thing with Iron Man and Daredevil in particular? Like, it mm-hmm. feels like constantly, you know?
Yeah, but this is just this is again peak Lee Romita. It seems like this era goes on forever, and that's a good thing because it just you can always turn to it, and you're still in development of characters like Gwen, Captain Stacy. Harry is still just, I hate Harry Osborn. I always have hated Harry Osborn.
Oh,
such a strange basketball haired freak. But he has
not nice.
Harry Osborn is so weird. He's just like the runt of the litter that you're, I don't get it.
He's the odd man out.
And MJ's always with him by default.
MJ's kind of great in an understated way.
Mm-hmm. MJ is hanging around because she's clearly pissed off that Peter chose Gwen over her, and she is biding her time, is the way I'm reading this.
I kind of am too, but she's being very cool about it.
Right.
It's not in a way where she's like, you know, being an asshole or anything, or
no.
I don't know. I kind of like her in a sneaky way.
I was going to say, you're not wrong about that. Also, Harry Osborn's still favorite goblin, but I digress. But yeah, I know. But, you know, like I said, I came up in that J.M. DeMatteis and Sal Buscema era of Spectacular Spider-Man, so I can't
look, I love
this issue.
Don't get me wrong. Can't wait with them.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to reading that again. But though that bit with MJ and Gwen, I would say that, yeah, they're both of these characters are starting to get a lot more agency now. It's like they've finally decided to start developing them into something other than just like strictly a love interest. There is a little bit more to their characters as we go forward. I mean, they're always going to be that primarily, but at least they're getting a few more dimensions now, so it doesn't feel like the same lines over and over again.
Absolutely. Well, unless you guys have something else you want to address here from Amazing Spider-Man 83 through 87, let's wrap up our discussion of 1970 Part 1 by talking about some of my favorite stuff, some Thor comics from Stan Lee and Jack Kirby.
Yes.
This time looking at Thor 175 through 177 that sees Loki essentially take the throne of Asgard by possessing the royal ring, taking it off of Odin's hand while he is in the Odin sleep and casting him into the, I believe it's the Sea of Eternal Night, where he will remain in Odin's sleep because nothing can move or advance or live there. It's a cool little take on it. Action-packed series of three issues, lots of Asgard, lots of Loki, lots of Thor. Kirby is continuing to draw the hell out of the concepts. Big dose of both Lady Sif and the Warriors 3. It's kind of everything. All the classic Thor elements are here in these three issues, and just reminds me when I read these of like how much I love these Asgard-based stories. You know, last time out we talked some cosmic Thor. Here we get back to the Asgard stuff, and it is once again much like the interpersonal drama of the Spider-Man comics, just a big plate of red meat because it's what I love about Thor comics. So. Loved a lot of these, unsurprisingly. Todd, what about you? I know you are also typically pretty high on this era of Thor books as well.
Yeah, to me, this is kind of the apex. This is the wonderful, wonderful peak of the Lee Kirby Thor. You have the Fall of Asgard. You have everything you need to have a classic story. Kirby drawing all kinds of great Asgardian crowd scenes and battle scenes. You have Odin snoring, which is always kind of cracks me up. Odin in this big tube that gets sent somewhere. You get Baldur, you know, the Galahad of the Marvel U or the Thor universe, being a noble sacrifice. And we get the debut, at least as far as I'm concerned, or have seen, of Surtur, kind of the big boss, right? The video game level, kind of the unkillable fire demon, Surtur, that, you know, we associate with Ragnarok, not just the movie, but the Walt Simonson run. We see here for the first time, drawn, and he feels like the literal devil in these books.
He actually appeared in 63 in a couple of different issues of Journey into Mystery, but I'm not sure those were on our reading list. I do not remember, honestly. So maybe the first time we've experienced them through this project, but not his first appearance in the pages of Thor.
And, you know, in contrast to, say, Fantastic Four, and I don't want to say Fantastic Four was phoned in, because those were still very good comics. You know, you had Kirby's 9-panel grids for much of that run. This, you have a lot bigger panels and a lot more detail, certainly a lot more going on. It, again, feels like it's Kirby doing all the heavy lifting and just Stan kind of scripting for me. Mm-hmm. I'm gonna assume that's what's going on. But a classic two run. We even get letter columns here thrown in. And that's kind of the exception, not the rule in Marvel Universe. So check out
Marvel Unlimited, of course, you mean.
I'm sure I said Marvel Unlimited, not Marvel Universe. Of course not. And this felt like the Game of Thrones of Thor. You know, it felt like you got and look who writes a letter in, I believe it is issue 176. It's somebody named Mark D. Matteis who writes letter into Thor. So that's pretty cool that you get future comics pros writing letters into Marvel at this point. And yeah, I dug the heck out of this. This was something I didn't have any reference for. I hadn't read. I believe I'd seen the cover of 177 before, because that is a classic Thor cover.
Yep. 176 is actually, I like a little bit better, because it has kind of that full cover image of Surtur on the front, which is cool. But yeah, glad to hear you do it as well. Tim, what about you? What were your thoughts here on this three-parter?
I love this Loki, who is just, he has conspired to move all these various elements that are in play, and is just see power and seize the opportunity here, because you've got Odin entering the Odin sleep. That's one thing. You've got Baldur and his merry men basically off dealing with the Queen of the Norn, and Thor is off, you know, in Midgard doing Midgard things. So there's really nobody there tending to the realm. And I love that he just kind of got the drop on everybody like that. He was thinking just far enough ahead and, you know, making these plans and gathering his army that by the time anyone was able to respond, he had already essentially taken the throne. And at that point, it's, well, what do we do? Now, I mean, he has the ring. He is essentially, I mean, whether there was some kind of power that prevented them from, you know, taking back the throne by force, or if it's just so ingrained in Asgardian culture and myth that they're not supposed to fuck around with the throne, it just plays out really, really well here. And you can say, I mean, it's well earned that Loki has stacked the deck so much that just it feels like the most personal and epic at the same time conflict that Thor has really faced to date in what we've read. I mean, we've seen one, we've seen the other. Certainly they went very epic with that Galactus story. Wasn't all that personal though, right? And I mean, we've seen the squabbles between he and Loki in earlier issues, but not on this kind of grand scale. So I loved how they were able to have this convergence over these three issues. And honestly, I think it could have comfortably gone like four issues. That finale was, I won't say rushed, but it just seemed like, you know, if Kirby was able to spread out and got another issue that very easily, that would have been entirely warranted. So yeah, I was thrilled by this through and through. Just a very fast, quick read. Just doesn't let up. All killer.
Yeah, absolutely. Russell, your thoughts here.
If one does not enjoy these three issues of Thor, may all thine offspring dwell atop trees. Also, if you don't get enjoyment out of Volstagg getting fatter and fatter and fatter with each progressive
Asgardian gypsy woman.
Yes, like he's
a fatter.
Dost thou get yes, Volstagg gets fatter, and he gets funnier. Like this, this is just like grand comedy throughout all this. I loved all the Warriors 3 stuff, and like Tim was saying, I also just loved how personal this is getting between Thor and Loki. This is an epic story from beginning to end. And the way I read the whole thing about the ring, the Odin ring, being basically making Loki into realm itself, like an attack on Loki would actually maybe cause real physical harm to the realm itself because he is in possession of the ring. And at least that's how I was interpreting it and why they
were. I think it's open for interpretation. Yeah,
like maybe that's why they weren't attacking him, because they've all taken an oath. But Baldur even says at one point in one of these issues that he had not taken any such oath. So he could like go physically for Loki and try to take him back. So once he frees Thor and the Warriors Three from their imprisonment, they concentrate more on freeing Lady Sif and taking the fight to Surtur, who Loki summarily runs away from as soon as he appears, because Loki was like, yeah, nah, fuck that. I don't really care if Asgard falls to pieces under this guy. I got the ring. That's all I came for. So great stuff, pretty much beginning to end here. I have absolutely – the only negative I have about these issues was the very start of it, whenever it looked like we were going to be doing Thor stops random mobsters who clearly aren't aware that it's not 1940 anymore. I mean, hey, give me that chapa. are we in Oh Brother Where Art Thou Now?
Yeah, Thor carrying the Tommy guns is pretty funny.
Yeah, I was like, this is really out of place. Then we switch over to all the Asgard stuff, and we completely forget about the whole Donald Blake thing, which it really seems like we're continuing to inch ever closer to that day where Donald Blake is no longer a thing. And these books prove that they will be all the better for it if they continue on that path. Just keep telling the Asgard stuff, this big like epic space stuff too. All of that is working. This is where it's at for 1970 at Marvel for me right now.
Yeah, I mean, essentially by this point, Don Blake, he may make the occasional random appearance, but he's virtually not a thing at this point at all anyway. They have moved on to far more interesting things rather than him spending time in his office with Jane Foster and all that. So, good stuff here all around. Anybody else got any points they want to make about Thor 175 through 177?
I don't want it to end, because I know Thor Thor stays it's going to be a while before Thor gets good post-Kirby.
Yeah, I mean, the problem with Thor is after Kirby leaves, the guys who take over just try to retell the same stories that Stan and Jack did for pretty much the next, like, 15 years until Simon comes on. So it's not a – we are entering one of the rough patches, one of the numerous rough patches in the Thor publishing history, but we will cross those bridges when we get there. Well, with all that being said, that brings an end to our reading list for part one of 1970. Be sure to come back next time for part two of our discussion of 1970 in the Marvel Universe, when we will be tackling Captain Marvel 20 through 21, Incredible Hulk 131 through 132, The Amazing Spider-Man 88 through 91, Fantastic Four 102 through 105, Captain America 130 through 132, and Avengers 83. Also, I feel relatively confident in saying that Tim's going to update the spreadsheet and perhaps post it in the PlayStation Comics Facebook group for all those who are interested in such a thing. That way you can read along if you're still interested in doing that. Let us know if you're actually still doing that. And, you know, always reach out to us on Facebook or Twitter with your opinions on our reading list. Love to hear some feedback from you guys. So we'll close the show as we do always with kind of hearing what everybody else has going on besides the Marvel Age podcast. You heard me earlier talk about Hard Traveling Fanboys in our recent episode. I have nothing else to add other than that you can find me on Twitter at NickDuke87. I am part of the aforementioned Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook group, though if I'm being honest, if you tag me in something, I probably just won't respond. Tim.
Confirmed.
What do you have going on?
Well, funny you should mention that. I will lift my Facebook embargo to the Marvel Age Remixed reading list. Sounds like we were pretty comfortable with this first outing here and try to proceed in this fashion. So give us your comments or suggestions, your criticisms if you want. And yeah, we will see where this leads us. I think it's been a lot of fun for me, honestly, just kind of doing this research and getting into the nitty gritty of what was published when and what was going on. And, you know, I don't know. It's an exercise I've actually enjoyed a lot more than I was expecting. In terms of other Place Me Nation podcasts, I think I ran down the most recent shows that you could find me on. Coming up, Jenny Smith and I do have our guest lined up for another episode of Talking Pop, so look for that on the Pop feed very soon. Of course, we will have Talking WCW as well, as we do every month, on the Place Me Nation wrestling feed. And I am on Twitter at Cyke68, C-Y-K-E-6-8.
Sweet. Russell. Yep. I have a brand new episode of my limited series, DC Post Crisis Management, coming up pretty soon, actually. May even be out by the certainly be out by the time you guys are hearing this, where I discuss the 2011 event Flashpoint with Jennifer Smith. It's the weirdest episode I've done yet. So hope you guys will enjoy just how bonkers I attempt to get in that one. But I hope you also find it very entertaining as we're heading into the home stretch now for this series. And you can also hear reasonably soon, I think, if it's not out already, the next episode of 90 to Nothing, where Sam Neely and I talk about a 1991 classic, Thelma and Louise, a movie that neither of us had seen prior to watching it for... Yes, neither of us had seen the movie prior to watching it for the episode, because we wanted to find one that was important and that we could go in cold on to see what our 2019 reaction to the film was. And to hear all that, just check out the latest episode of 90 to Nothing. I think you guys will enjoy that one. And you can find me, of course, on Twitter and Instagram at Russell_Sellers.
There you go. Todd, what about you? What you got going on?
Hey, check out my new show on Place to Be Nation Pop. We talked about it before in the live reads. It's called Binge Please. Also, listen to Conversation Comics featuring Tim Capel. Listen to Marvel Age. Wait, you are listening to Marvel Age. So those are the places you can hear me on our network. Plus, check me out at Todd Weber Guitar on Twitter, Guitars of Green on Instagram.
There you go, Guitar Green. Instagram plugs being added. The world is expanding, and I don't quite know what to make of it. Well, we hope you've enjoyed.
Yeah, you've never spent any time on Instagram looking at anything.
Sir, I have never spent 1 second on Instagram. The court records will reflect that. In any event, that brings an end to this episode of the Marvel Edge Podcast. We hope you join us next time. Look forward to talking some more 1970 next time out. So from all of us here at the Sarcastic Four, we hope you enjoyed this episode. Enough said. We'll be right back.